I want to talk about Narnia for just a moment. It's something that I was raised on. I've got a really nice old hardback edition that I was given kind of when I was like 10 years old, basically, that I was reading with my kids about a year ago. And I still absolutely love these stories, right? They still hold so much meaning and value to me. I think it's true to say that Narnia holds a special place in many people's hearts, although I'm finding more and more people just haven't heard of it these days, which is also interesting. But I kind of got a question around this. Let me just kind of go through this. So we see Lewis express Christianity through narrative in a way that children can grasp with Narnia. So can you explore what Narnia is all about and what Lewis hopes to achieve by putting it to paper and publishing it?
Well, I mean, first of all, put to bed the idea that Narnia is an allegory. It's often described as such, and that's not quite fair. Lewis called it an imaginative supposal. So the most famous book and movie is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And Lewis said, well, what might it be like if the second person of the Trinity, what if Christ made a world like Narnia and became incarnate there as well, died and rose again? What would that be like? And that's really what Narnia is trying to answer. It's kind of like some speculative fan fiction. And what Lewis was trying to achieve was to write a children's story. He had not any children of his own at the time. He eventually looked after his wife's when after they married, because she had two sons, David and Douglas. But he had not had any real contact with children. And he came down for breakfast one morning and announced that he was going to try and write a children's book. And his brother and his sort of mother, she was an older lady. There's a story behind that, because he was taking care of her because one of his comrades died in the First World War, and he promised that he would look after his mother. But they roared with laughter because they thought it was just so ridiculous. You have this stuffy don from Oxford, an English and a philosophy teacher, and he's the one that's going to try and write a children's book. But Lewis had always loved literature, and we've already spoken about the power of imagination and myth and the things that really captivated him. And he wanted to try his hand at it, and he'd had several images in his head that he wanted to try out, one of which was a fawn with an umbrella walking through a forest that was filled with snow. But when we look at what he actually does in Narnia, we see that he certainly does communicate the Christian worldview, but under different symbols. And it's probably worth mentioning that he had written Out of the Silent Planet before he wrote Narnia. And that is effectively a sci-fi story. A man is kidnapped and taken to Mars. He has some adventures and then he comes back. And Lewis commented in a letter to one of his friends, Sister Penelope. He said that, I think it was out of 60 reviews, only two of them had any inkling that he had been communicating things about philosophy and theology. And he writes to Sister Penelope, oh, if only there was somebody that had better talent and more time, this great ignorance could be used for the evangelism of England. And he said, any amount of theology can now be smuggled into people's minds under the cover of, he calls it romance, we would say fiction or adventure. And he also spoke about the ability to get past people's watchful dragons. Basically, that if one is resistant to Christianity or even aggressive towards it, one can read a story that doesn't appear, at least from the outset, to have anything to do with Christianity, but it can A, communicate some Christian ideas, and B, allow you to enter in and see with those other eyes that Lewis talks about in An Experiment in Criticism. And that, I would say, is what he's really doing with Narnia. You get to see what a Christian worldview is like, but also a fantastical one, you know, one that is set in a world of talking beasts. So we deal with things like the deaths of parents. In The Magician's Nephew, Lewis basically rewrites his mother's story, although this time she doesn't die, but she's healed with an apple. But we deal with lots of very weighty philosophical topics, but still under the guise of a children's book. And I'm actually going to be interviewing someone on the show later this season where we're actually going to talk about the apologetics that we find in Narnia, because it challenges certain presuppositions and worldviews. In The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, we hear one of the characters say, in our world, a star is a flaming ball of gas. And it receives the response that, my son, even in your world, that is not what a star is. It's only what it is made of. So someone that's reading that is already prepared to see the difference between what something is made of and what it actually is, basically lightly refuting a sort of materialistic worldview, opening them to realities that they can't just, you know, see and touch. And so Lewis does this throughout Narnia. In The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, he has a version of his trilemma, which people may have heard of from Mere Christianity, that Jesus is either a liar, a lunatic, or Lord. And if you look at the conversation about what Lucy saw in the wardrobe, you see it basically boils down to those same three options. So very often you can read Narnia and then you can pick up Lewis's apologetic or literary criticism, and you find very similar sorts of arguments there, but now out in the open and displayed very clearly. Whereas when he's telling us about them in Narnia, he's telling them us in such a way as to get past our watchful dragons. And probably I shouldn't mention Narnia without mentioning at least one other thing, and that's Planet Narnia. So a lot of people read Narnia growing up, and they're shocked to discover that there is a very popular theory among Lewis scholars. It was put forward relatively recently by a scholar named Dr. Michael Ward. And it's basically showing that Narnia is meant to be mimicking the seven heavens of the medieval cosmos. And in a nutshell, it's this idea that each of the planets in the medieval cosmos has a theme, an atmosphere, things associated with it. And what Lewis is doing is he's, in each of the seven Narnian Chronicles, he is trying to incarnate some of those ideas in that book. So, for example, in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, it's the Jupiter book. So it's all about Jove and joviality, which is why you have Father Christmas there, the quintessential jovial man. In Prince Caspian, you have, that's the Mars book. And so that book is all about knights and swords and martial attacks. And also Mars was associated with trees. And anyone that knows Prince Caspian will know that the trees play a huge role in the story. So there was a lot that Lewis was doing in Narnia. And so the only other thing I would end with is just to caution people trying to pigeonhole it a little bit too neatly. It wasn't simply Christian propaganda.
Yeah, it's I just think it's just really well written. For me, the two books that always stick with me the most for the sort of harrowing but honest dialogues is The Magician's Nephew and then The Last Battle. Magician's Nephew, mm-hmm. when they're dealing with both the magician and also the kind of evil queen, those two characters still scare me to this day in my mid-30s. And in The Last Battle, the very, very last scene where Aslan's kind of letting certain people through the door and other people or other animals he's not, and there's that really, I say it's a famous scene, but this is how I've recollected it in my mind, is this scene where some of the animals don't want to follow Aslan, don't want to follow this way, and then turn around but lose the ability to speak as they move away and kind of walk off into the distance. And it's still, whenever I read it, it still sends shivers down my spine. Like, it's so, such a powerful metaphor. I don't know, any recollections or thoughts on that before we press on?
Oh, I have goosebumps. Yes, I remember the first time I heard The Last Battle, and that gave me chills. But it's an idea that you find throughout Lewis, insofar as the closer we get to God, the more personality we really have. The further we get away from him, the less we have. He says in Mere Christianity that if you want to see people that are all from the same cookie-cutter mold, boring, not special in any way, he says, go look at the tyrants. But he says if you want to see a variety of people, radically different, that's when you go to the saints. You go and look at those great people of sanctity, and you find those are the people that are fully alive. And it's the great tyrants that are just doing, you know, the same tired old sins, just in maybe slightly more creative ways. And the other thing I want to point out about that scene in The Last Battle is it's not so much that Aslan doesn't let them in; it's the fact that they look at him and they don't like what they see. So the animals come to him in turn, and those that look at him in love go and join him, and those that don't. And that's an idea that you find a lot in Lewis. The idea that hell is a door locked from the inside, that it's ultimately life with God forever or not. And it is a self-choice.